hours every first and third Monday of the month from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Our nurse can also book follow-up appointments for other STI tests depending on your risk factors or results. Come check us out at our accessible location on 77 Westmount Road, Unit 110, or get more info at www.archguelph.ca/testing.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Listen to Back in the USSR. Hello, comrades. This is Siegfried. I'd like to devote this week's show, which is only my second show of 2019. It's a little hard to believe that I just, you know, restarted the show just as of last week. You know, feels like I've been doing it all year. But this is actually only the second show of this year, seeing we had our hiatus where I was in China, which, of course, I talked about on the last episode, all about me teaching English in China and what that was like, doing that for the third time and all that. But what I'd like to do, what I'd like to turn my attention to this week is the issue of climate change. And I'd like to turn my attention to that for a number of very immediate reasons. And obviously, I'll get to that. But first, I'd like to give a salute to the Syrian Arab Army, a force which does not get any of the credit that it deserves for what it does in the Western press. In fact, it's actually actively demonized in the Western press. But the Syrian Arab Army, the National Army of Syria, has just liberated this key city of Khan Shaykhun from Turkish-backed rebel groups in Syria. And some of you might recognize the name because Khan Shaykhun is the same city where that unconfirmed and dubiously reported, quote, chemical weapons attack took place a few years back. Remember when Donald Trump, the mainstream media said, like, you know, he became presidential all of a sudden when he launched all those cruise missiles against Syria a few years back? Right. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about here. He blamed, apparently this chemical attack happened. Very, very dubious evidence for it. Donald Trump proceeds to blame the Syrian government for it, even though the Syrian government had destroyed its stockpiles of chemical weapons in 2014 under UN supervision. And of course, then he used the supposed attack as a pretext for bombing Syria. And then there was all this talk about he had that one CNN anchor quoting Leonard Cohen saying, like, you know, we're guided by the beauty of our weapons or something like that. And like talking all this almost weirdly kinky kind of like symbolism around the cruise missiles that the U.S. is launching, which were killing people in Syria at that time on the basis of like this weird, the supposed chemical weapons attack, which, we don't really know that much about. Which there was a major rush to judgment in terms of like attributing blame. And there was no evidence that the Syrian government ever did it, but that was used as a pretext for the US and the UK to launch all these bombing runs against Syria at that time, 2 years ago. And that of course happened at Khan Shaykhun. Now of course the Syrian flag flies proudly over Khan Shaykhun, and the rebel groups backed by imperialist powers are running for their lives. And of course, I've talked many times on this show about the conflict in Syria, and now right from the beginning, a whole string of, U.S. allies and the United States itself. This was the biggest CIA operation of the 21st century, pumping guns, pumping weapons, pumping funding, training to militant groups in Syria, just fueling the fire of that conflict in which hundreds of thousands of people died. The U.S. has been in there fueling that conflict from day one. And so this victory of the Syrian Arab Army, this reclamation of this land and this part of Syria, which was under occupation from foreign-backed groups, this is a real victory for the forces fighting against imperialism in the name of self-determination around the world. But this episode of the show is dedicated to the issue of climate change. I just wanted to do that little, piece at the beginning there. It's dedicated to the issue of climate change, an issue that is intimately tied with the forces of capitalism and empire. And I'd like to start out with a quote from the Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro that appeared in Granma, the Cuban national newspaper, back in 2009. In that year, Fidel wrote an article discussing the 2009 United Nations Climate Change Conference. And this is one of the things that he said, quote, "The youth is more interested than anyone else in the future. Until very recently, the discussion revolved around the kind of society we would have. Today, the discussion centers on whether human society will survive. These are not dramatic phrases. We must get used to the true facts. Hope is the last thing human beings can relinquish," end quote. And comrades, I believe that this passage accurately captures the essence of the present global situation that we face today with climate change. As if in confirmation of Fidel's words, in 2016, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued a report that stated that we only have 12 years to seriously curb carbon emissions if we want to avoid a climate catastrophe. And according to the report, the world is currently 1 degree Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels, In 2018, the UN Intergovernmental, you know, the IPCC, issued another report that noted that things were actually much worse than previously thought. And the predictions are very bleak, quite frankly. You know, worsening of environmental disasters across the globe, such as forest fires, tsunamis, hurricanes, floods, droughts. At 2 degrees warming worldwide, which is what they're reporting now, we're headed towards a future where the population of insects is predicted to halve. 99% of the coral reefs are predicted to die. And extreme weather events have been very prevalent in the last few years, with heat waves such as the 2019 Indo-Pakistani heat wave, which killed 184 people. And since 2004, India and Pakistan have experienced 11 of the 15 warmest days on record, like ever. And so climate change is happening. It's real. You know, there is no turning back. There's only delaying the inevitable. We will literally have to transform society to adapt to where the world's going. And that's why we need communism. Or more precisely, why we need communist theories such as those espoused by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and why we need to build the struggle for socialism worldwide. Putting people before profits is no longer an empty catchphrase to be thrown around by any two-bit activist on the block. It's a matter of survival. Those who struggle for socialism, for working-class-centered democratic control over the economy and society, have to realize that they are no longer fighting solely for human progress and social justice and economic justice, but also so that human beings may have a future at all. You know, if capitalism remains in command, if profits remain in command of society, humanity dies, plain and simple. You know, capitalism, carbon emissions, extractive industries, all these things are degrading the earth, polluting the atmosphere, degrading the ecosystems, the biosphere, the natural forces that we need to survive. And this, of course, is threatening us with extinction, threatening human beings with extinction. And it's very interesting to note that in 1876, Friedrich Engels, you know, Karl Marx's collaborator, said the following, quote, "Let us not flatter ourselves overmuch on account of our human conquest over nature. For each such conquest takes its revenge on us. At every step, we are reminded that we by no means rule over nature like a conqueror over a foreign people, like someone standing outside of nature, but that we, with flesh, blood, and brain, belong to nature and exist in its midst." End quote. That was Friedrich Engels, and he couldn't have said it better. You know, in the 19th century, he was saying just how much human beings are dependent on nature. They're part of nature. They must respect nature. They must, you know, exist within nature, not think that we can exist outside of it. He understood that at that time. You know, about 150 years ago. And as Michael Parenti pointed out in his book, Black Shirts and Reds, Rational Fascism and the Overthrow of Communism, Michael Parenti, who was a progressive author and scholar, said, quote, "With its never-ending emphasis on exploitation and expansion, and its indifference to environmental costs, capitalism appears determined to stand outside nature." End quote. Even as individual capitalists advertise themselves and claim to be green in this day and age, capitalism's commodification and exploitation of the planet, its resources, and people, you know, including such life-sustaining resources as arable land, groundwater, wetlands, forests, fisheries, ocean beds, rivers, air quality, etc., This has caused the very life support systems of the Earth to degrade and threaten the survival of the human species. One of the things I wanted to bring up tonight was the fires currently raging in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil. There's been an 84% increase in fires in the Amazon rainforest as compared to last year. And there's ample evidence that illegal loggers, cattle ranchers, and mining companies have been literally putting the rainforest to the torch in order to enhance their profits, in order to clear land for ranching, clear land for mining, grab the timber. Like destroying the very lungs of the planet, as these rainforests have often been referred to, along with the lands of dozens of indigenous nations, so that they can make more money. And all the while the would-be fascist dictator Jair Bolsonaro, president of Brazil, does all he can to facilitate this bonanza of plunder and destruction. And this is the same Bolsonaro who was hailed by the CBC last year upon his election for his commitment to free markets and for providing opportunities for Canadian businesses, particularly in the mining industry. And this is how he's delivering on those opportunities. You know, he's burning up the Amazon and clearing the way for those extractive industries that rule Bay Street. You know, the Amazon is burning, but I'm sure those mining companies, you know, based on Bay Street, are going to be making a killing. Because this is like pretty much one of the major, you know, multinational. I mean, these are the kind of multinational corporations that are based in Canada and operate all around the world. And they certainly have no problem if the Amazon is burning, if they can get in there with their mines and their heavy equipment and all that stuff and extract the wealth from the ground. Capitalism doesn't think long term. Capitalism thinks about profitability, short-term profitability, and maybe the next quarter. That's about it. And we see the impact that that is having on the planet and on the biosphere that we depend on. Here's an August 22nd clip, you know, so from today, from the Real News Network that gets further into the situation in the Amazon. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News. I'm Tharna Noor. The Amazon rainforest is burning at a record rate. The fires are so big that you can see the smoke from NASA's space satellites. On Monday, the sky turned black over the city of Sao Paulo, Brazil, and meteorologists found that the smoke filling the sky there was from fires from thousands of kilometers away. Brazil's National Institute for Space Research has documented almost 73,000 forest fires this year already. That's an 84% uptick from what they saw in the same period last year. And this comes amid a spike in deforestation in Brazil under right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro. He took office in January. But on Wednesday, Bolsonaro said that NGOs are to blame for this uptick in fires. Now joining me to talk about this is Christian Poirier, who directs Amazon Watch's Brazil program. Thank you so much for being here today, Christian.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, a number of factors can contribute to these wildfires. Increased dry periods because of climate change, increased logging. Some fires are even created intentionally to clear land for agribusiness. Talk about all of those factors and why we're seeing this huge spike in fires in the Amazon.
Under President Jair Bolsonaro, who is now in the eighth month of his tenure, we have seen an explosion in deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Almost all of this deforestation is considered illegal. One report said 95% of deforestation we're seeing today should be considered irregular or illegal. And this is due to the rhetoric of Jair Bolsonaro and indeed his policies, which are entirely anti-environmental and antagonistic to human rights as well, especially to the rights of indigenous peoples who occupy the Amazon, 22% of which is indigenous territories. So the giant spike in deforestation we're seeing today, a 67% spike since last year, and the signals that Bolsonaro is sending to rural actors, farmers, and also illegal actors, militias, and mafias that are operating with wanton impunity under his reign, is driving a process of illegal invasions of protected areas like indigenous territories and other protected forests, the intentional setting of fires, the 73,000 fires we are seeing today, almost all of these were set intentionally because in Brazil, this is considered the burning season. This is not unusual. What is unusual is the 84% spike since last year. This is a humongous growth in forest fire setting, and the scale of these forests are forest fires are unprecedented. What we see as well is Bolsonaro trying to shift the blame from his own real responsibility for the massive destruction of the Amazon and the attack on indigenous and other traditional peoples who live there, by shifting the blame to nonprofits, NGOs that are doing very good work to try to protect the Amazon and its peoples. This is a pathological denial of the truth that we all are quite aware with, are quite familiar with here in the United States under Donald Trump. Fake news is a motto of these leaders. It's also denial of science. The stats you cited earlier, the 72,843 fires we witnessed today, are from Brazil's Space Research Center, INPE. INPE director was sacked just a couple of weeks ago because for telling the truth, for doing his job, for showing that deforestation is on the rise. And Jair Bolsonaro went on record saying that this is fake news, that INPE is trying to smear Brazil's reputation, when in fact it's doing its job. It's doing its job showing Brazilians and showing the world about the environmental catastrophe that is befalling the Amazon today.
Now, deforestation was on the rise even before Bolsonaro was elected. The National Space Research Institute that you just cited says that it's been increasing since 2012. So how much worse has it gotten since Bolsonaro was elected, and why? Who is he responding to? Why is he sort of enacting all these policies, allowing more logging, more deforestation in general?
Deforestation has indeed been rising since 2012, as you say, but the spike we're witnessing today is of enormous concern. It's incredibly alarming. And what Bolsonaro is doing is he's responding to the calls of Brazil's agribusiness sector, the people who actually brought him to power, to open up protected areas in the Brazilian Amazon to extractive industry and agribusiness and to infrastructure development. He is answering the call of this sector and doing their bidding. Basically, Brazil's agribusiness sector is running the show in Brazil today alongside mining. And what we see is that these actors who have long sought to open up protected areas, protected forests, indigenous territories to their activities are acting with impunity. They're acting with incredible lawlessness, and they're seeing this the complete absence of the state. The government has gutted the ability of the environmental agency, IBAMA, to monitor and enforce environmental law in the Amazon. And the signal that this sends is that these actors can go ahead and set fires to the forest, attack, invade, and terrorize, in fact, even kill indigenous peoples who live there with impunity. So this is of enormous concern. It's not something we witnessed previously. This is very much what Bolsonaro has brought to the table as president.
You've mentioned the impact on the indigenous folks still living in the Amazon. And of course, you know, these fires there have a global impact. But could we talk a little bit about how they're affecting the folks who are actually there? Some 1 million people are still living in the Amazon. You recently visited the Amazonian state of Pará, where the Munduruku people live, I believe. What do these fires and these policies contribute, either contribute to them, do to these populations? And then what kind of resistance is mounting amongst those populations, too?
Well, indigenous peoples are really on the front lines today of the most brutal attack on their rights and on the forest in 30 years. We're seeing the rollback of 30 years of progress on human rights and environmental protections in Brazil today. Indeed, hearkening back to Brazil's military dictatorship, the times that Jair Bolsonaro eulogizes that he calls back to all the time, and what he'd like to see sort of a regime installed that's doing similar, have a similar agenda of wanton destruction of the forest for so-called environmental progress. And indigenous people, as I mentioned, are suffering the brunt of this attack today. I was recently on the river Tapajós in the state of Pará. Mm. Pará is burning today. And I was with the Munduruku people. The Munduruku people have been resisting for centuries, the incursions of outsiders, be them the Portuguese, a variety of other actors, including now today the Brazilian state, who want to build dams on their river, who want to allow wanton destruction of their territories by way of logging and mining, and who are absolutely absent in their constitutional duty to title and defend Munduruku territories. Just after I left Munduruku territory of Sairi Maibu, the Munduruku carried out what's called an auto-demarcation activity because the state has not demarcated this territory, leaving it open to a variety of threats, acute threats that I witnessed. Diamond and gold mining rampant in the region, polluting waterways, destroying forests, and then we have also illegal loggers acting completely in open impunity. And we see as well the Munduruku needing to resist and defend their territories on their own without any federal support. They went onto their territories and drove illegal loggers off of their land and did so on their own at great peril, because wow. These are armed militias we're seeing them go up against today. The murder of the YAP leader in the northern state of Amapá shows that stakes are rising for indigenous peoples. The Munduruku and others are really on the front lines of these struggles and need to be supported.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, the stakes are rising for the rest of the world as well. A report from the Brazilian research center, Amazon, showed that some 20% of the Amazon was destroyed in the 20th century. And then last month on The Real News, we spoke with Alexander Zajcek, who found in a report for The Intercept, actually, that if we lose another 20% of the Amazon, and that could happen in less than 30 years, it could trigger what scientists call this dieback loop, where, you know, the forest could start to dry out and burn on its own until it was completely obliterated. Of course, the Amazon stores carbon, so it slows global warming. It supplies 20% of the world's oxygen. It's also responsible for 10% of the world's biodiversity. What happens if we lose the Amazon? What happens to the global population if we lose this incredible resource?
The Amazon is indeed approaching what specialist scientists have been calling a tipping point for some time. The moment it crosses that tipping point, it will no longer be able to create its own climate, its own rainfall, and sustain itself as the life-giving rainforest that we all need to act as a buffer against runaway climate change. The Amazon creates weather patterns around the world. It also creates rainfall for Brazil and for Brazil's agribusiness sector. So it's incredibly, should be seen as an incredible shot in the foot for the sector to be sponsoring the wholesale destruction of the forest today. But if we see the Amazon lost, we will go with it. The Amazon is essential to our survival. It's essential to the stability of our climate. And we all have a responsibility to seeing that it's protected.
And what needs to happen to end this crisis? Who needs to be held accountable? And how do we do that?
Well, first and foremost, we need to hold the Bolsonaro regime accountable for its responsibility in driving this crisis today. But Bolsonaro has cut off ties with all forms of resistance to his government, or even attempts to dialogue with his government, from the social and environmental justice movements in Brazil, including Brazil's National Indigenous Movement. So what we're seeing is that these movements are taking their movements, their struggles to a global level. And they're calling for accountability from international buyers of Brazilian commodities. Brazilian markets are very dependent on export commodities like soy and beef, timber and other commodities that are vulnerable to market pressures and political pressure abroad, especially in Europe, which is the second largest importer of Brazilian commodities. We need to see Europe take a leadership at this critical moment to push back and say it will not be buying commodities from Brazil that are linked to illegal deforestation and rights abuses. We need to see European politicians, the European Parliament, do not ratify the EU-Mercosur trade agreement under these conditions. We need to see that these trade blocs do not allow for open free trade under these conditions. We need to see much better standards put into supply chain management and the protection of forests and human rights foremost over trade. This needs to be conditions that are installed over any sort of trade regime to protect the Amazon, because this is one language the Bolsonaro government will understand. International boycotts of conflict commodities, the closing of markets, this is the language they'll understand. They're not going to understand the language of dignity, of responsibility, of human rights, of environmental protection, everything we expect from our leaders. They're not going to hear this. So we need to we have a responsibility internationally, in the North America, in Europe, in Asia, to make a stand against this destruction, because it's all of our responsibility. It really implicates all of us.
Okay, well, as you at Amazon Watch continue to mount this, this disruption, to continue to fight this and document the struggles and the fights of indigenous populations in Brazil and elsewhere, we'd love to hear from you again. Christian Paurier, the director of Amazon Watch's Brazil program, thank you so much for being on the Real News Network today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was the report from the Real News Network entitled "The Amazon is Burning at a Record Rate." And I think that really highlights the point I'm trying to make here on this show, that capitalism is the problem, comrades, not the solution. You know, like I said before, there's all this like talk about introducing green tech and all this sort of stuff and green capitalism and all that jazz. But the introduction of solar panels or any other form of green technology cannot change the underlying logic of a system built upon the limitless exploitation of finite resources. You know, and just limitless expansion of profits on the basis of resource extraction, of the exploitation of the natural world, and the transformation of nature into commodities that can then be bought and sold. There is a limit on that. You know, the resources are finite. They're not infinite. In order for us to do anything about climate change, we need to stop that process. We need to redirect that process into human need, not into profitability. We need to take control over the means of production and put it into the hands of working class people. When I say that, I mean that in order to combat climate change, we need to put industry and commerce under the democratic control of working class and oppressed people, and indigenous people in particular, as that report highlighted, so that they can choose their own destiny. They can decide what is best for them. You know, not what's most profitable, but what is best for them. And this includes thinking long term. This includes planning. This is thinking about the public good and where we want to go from here. We're thinking about our own survival of our kids. You know, socialism can plan long term. They can look out for long term well-being. Capitalism cannot. Capitalism is just focused on this quarter or maybe the next in terms of profitability and maximizing profit. Socialism is not about profit. It's about human needs and ensuring human needs continue to be met and the human well-being continues to advance over the long term. This is something socialism can do. Right now, in the world today, we're headed for what has been termed climate apartheid, and the UN has dubbed it climate apartheid. According to a recent United Nations report, by 2030, 120 million people will be forced into poverty and hunger because of climate change. The rich will be able to pay their way out of suffering, the consequences of Earth's climate change, while the vast majority of people will be suffering. And this June 2019 report by the UN's Human Rights Council describes how the world's 3.5 billion poorest people who are responsible for only 10% of the world's carbon emissions, While the richest 10% of the global population are responsible for more than half. So, you know, like even in that report there, I mean, you had this kind of like false balancing going on, you know, a little bit of false balancing. You know, the whole idea that each one of the, you could say the 99% are somehow just as responsible as the 1% for what's going on right now, which of course is completely wrong. You know, the wealthy, the capitalists, the exploiters, these people are responsible overwhelmingly. You know, the people who run the corporations, the people who set the agenda for the corporations and the Fortune 500 and all that kind of stuff, they're the ones responsible overwhelmingly for the current climate situation. I mean, to quote directly from this UN report, perversely, the richest who have the greatest capacity to adapt and are responsible for and have benefited from the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions will be the best placed to cope with climate change, while the poorest, who have contributed the least to emissions and have the least capacity to react, will be the most harmed. An over-reliance on the private sector could lead to a climate apartheid scenario in which the wealthy pay to escape overheating, hunger, and conflict, while the rest of the world is left to suffer. End quote. And comrades, this is why we need to fight for socialism in the world right now, because we need to ensure that there is a future for humanity, and not just a future for the richest of humanity with the kind of funds that allow them to hide out in luxury underground bunkers or go to Mars. I mean, we need socialism because our world is changing. And just like Fidel Castro said in 2009, today the discussion centers on whether human society will survive. You know, we've literally reached that point. You know, socialism, the ability to focus the economy on human needs and not on profitability, not on corporate greed. You know, and the ability to plan long term as opposed to just to looking to the next quarter and the profits of the next quarter. Socialism isn't a trend. It's a tool in the hands of working class people that they can use to secure their own liberation and survival. And right now, these two things go hand in hand all over the world. So we need to understand how socialism can and is effectively working to combat climate change today. You know, despite Western propaganda against communism, you know, striving to mislead public opinion, the truth is that socialist states run by communist parties, both historically and presently, have shown the success of socialist economics and politics and the role that they can play in managing disasters, in fighting fascism, and in safeguarding the interests of the vast majority of people. You know, we can take inspiration from countries such as Cuba, you know, that actively look long-term, actively plan out where they want to go in the coming years, actively set an agenda for economic development that puts human beings first, and that have begun to embark upon a 100-year plan to fight climate change. Tarea Vida, or Project Life, is a comprehensive plan to combat climate change in Cuba, which has been adopted in the spring of 2017 by Cuba's Council of Ministers. It involves 11 projects ranging from identifying and implementing actions and projects to adapt to climate change, you know, projects of a comprehensive ongoing nature to ensuring the availability and efficient use of water as part of confronting drought, to the management and use of available international financial resources, both those from global and regional climate funds and those from bilateral resources to make investments, carry out actions, and implement projects related to the tasks outlined in the state plan. This is a 100-year plan. You know, talk about thinking long-term. They're looking over the next century and what they're going to do, where they want to be, what kind of resources they're going to mobilize to make sure that the Cuban people, that their needs are met, that their needs are advanced, that the economy focuses on their needs and their own survival in this changing environment that we're in. You know, and combating emissions and and transitioning to new forms of technology and all that. As the United States continues to show that it's not willing to take global leadership in combating climate change, countries such as China are showing the world their willingness to deal with the problem. In 2017, the United States withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord. Meanwhile, China, whose economy includes long-term economic planning, China stayed in that accord. And according to recent data, China is 9 years ahead of schedule in their plan to reach carbon emission goals set in the Paris Climate Accord. And considering China accounts for one-third of the world's pollution, that's massive. I mean, in recent years, China has done things like assigning 60,000 soldiers of the People's Liberation Army to plant trees in an effort to fight climate change, you know, building the world's largest humidifier, standing at a staggering 328 feet, you know, the biggest, which was built in an effort to fight pollution, dramatically reducing its consumption of coal, constructing the largest wind and solar power stations in the world, China is also creating experimental cities like Luzhou Forest City, which will be open in 2020 and is set to include 1 million plants and 40,000 trees, and which can house a total of 30,000 people, and which will absorb 57 tons of carbon dioxide every year while producing 900 tons of oxygen. I mean, last episode of Back in the USSR last week, I talked about, Ian Goodrum, the journalist for China Daily, who I interviewed for the Communist Current podcast last month. And, last week I played, what he had to say about the situation in Hong Kong. But he also talked a bit about China's efforts to improve the environment and to combat climate change. And this is what he had to say about that. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I noticed a lot of buses were hybrid electric. I had one more. I actually do have a question about public transit. When I was in Beijing, I noticed a lot of buses were hybrid electric. Do you know anything about that?
I do. You've given me an opportunity to whip out one of my favorite statistics. Yes, there's a lot of electric buses in Beijing, but there's a lot of electric buses in China, and here is exactly how many. Bloomberg reported just a month or so ago that there are only 425,000 electric buses in operation around the world, and 411,000 of those are in China.
Wow.
So we're talking about, well above 90% in terms of how much of the electric bus fleet is in this one country. The other fun thing is that China has laid more railway track than the rest of the world twice over. Clearly there's moves, I think, within the next couple years to change all the official taxi fleets of major cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen to electric as well. So there's a mass campaign right now to transition people from internal combustion engine vehicles to new energy vehicles, plug-in hybrids and battery hybrids, plug-in hybrids and full electric cars. And it's starting with the fleets of service vehicles, which, of course, that make up a big part of any major city's traffic. And I'll just add as well, there are incentive programs to get people to junk or switch to electric with their personal vehicles too. There's a lottery system for license plates in Beijing that is very it's notoriously difficult to get a license plate for your car because there's such a big waiting list. But if you purchase a new energy vehicle, there's no lottery system at all. You get your license plate. So there are lots of incentives at work to make people switch over without, obviously if it's a public bus fleet or a public taxi fleet, you can just make the switch easily. There's no question about it. You're not changing anybody's car. The cab driver, it's not like a ride share program where the cab driver is responsible for the maintenance on their own car. They're driving a fleet car. So that it's very easy to switch, but then you're also incentivizing people to make the switch in their personal lives. So I think the goal is to get rid of all internal combustion engine vehicles by 2030, but you can't. I'm not sure if you can quote me on that because the year might not be precise. But it is certainly a goal in the future. And environmental policy is a whole other topic. We can talk about the fact that in the U.S. people are debating and discussing the particulars of the so-called Green New Deal, while China is doing exactly what the Green New Deal lays out everywhere. They're not wasting any time. But that's a whole other mm-hmm. discussion.
But it is very impressive. I certainly noticed some of that, when I was in Ningbo, personally, the kind of bus fleet they had there, right? And the focus on building new subways, building new systems so people get around, and this definitely is very, very impressive. And of course, it refutes the kind of propaganda we get about China kind of once again being that kind of hellscape where you never see the sun. I think, a few years ago, they had that whole thing, which turned out to be completely untrue in the Western press, where it was
advertisement, right?
The rising sun, put on big screens in the middle of Beijing because, nobody could, see through the smog, that kind of thing. And, this was a whole, whole thing in the Western press. Turned out, not to be have any foundation in reality, but...
No, it was just an advertisement. Right. That of course you carefully take the picture to make it look a certain way, I actually got to experience this firsthand whenever I was at the this kind of manipulation of imagery. I was at the what are called the two sessions, the yearly government sessions of the National People's Congress and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. These are the two top legislative bodies in the country. And so there were lots of foreign journalists there at the Great Hall of the People. And, you know, because it's the top government meeting where these important delegates are meeting and we're going in, there are guards. There are People's Armed Police guards. And I got to see firsthand a photographer. I didn't ask who they were with, but they were white, so probably with a Western media outlet. I saw them waiting to take a picture of the Great Hall until a group of People's Armed Police marched by. They waited until the police were in front of the hall before taking the picture.
Right.
So you can project a certain image that way. It's like the that photo of Iran that gets used for every story of a woman in a veil walking in front of that painting of the Statue of Liberty with the decaying face. It gets used for every story because it's useful for the image you want to project of the country. And you don't have to stage it. You can just wait for the opportune moment and then take the picture.
Yeah.
So same with that. And as far as the sky goes, I mean, I would have to walk to my window and look, but it's the summer, so it's usually pretty good anyway. But even in the dead of winter, you'll get perfectly fine air quality. I'm fortunate to have come in the fall of 2017, because because this was around the time that there started to really be a change. The people that have been around longer have said, yeah, you know, it used to be pretty bad, but now it's night and day. So yeah, right now the AQI is at 53, which is considered good, but every other, yeah, I'm looking at my app here, everything else is in the green. So, you know, if I looked outside, it would be pretty blue. But this is the reputation, you know. You get a what is essentially a meme going about a country, and that becomes the association everybody has with it. So this is the persistent image that people have. You, despite the changes that have been made, despite all the coal-fired power plants closing down,
right,
despite the changes in heating sources that have allowed there to be blue clear skies in northeastern China again. It doesn't matter, because the image that has been really, really pushed is the one that sticks around and the one that sticks in people's minds. So you have to really fight to make clear that, you know, this, we're in a different place now. China's changing all the time, and thinking about China as if, you know, a couple 5 years, 10 years, or even a couple years ago is the same place that it is now is totally wrong, because it's, you know, a few years ago, people were using cash for everything. Now they're not. There's lots of examples of how things are changing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Ian Goodrum, journalist for China Daily, who I interviewed for the Communist Current podcast last month, along with Clara Sorrenti, you know, my comrade in London. Now, And you can see the difference that that makes. I mean, we're talking about the kinds of things that China can do because it has at least, like, overall, it's a planned economy. You know, there are large capitalist segments of it, private sector segments of it. But overall, I mean, the commanding heights of the Chinese economy are publicly owned and publicly planned. And they're planned long term, you know, in 5-year plans, this kind of thing. You know, the Communist Party plans at where they want to be in 5 years. You know, where do they want the economy to be in 5 years? What are the priorities? What do they want to develop? What do they want to advance? And this is the same thing Cuba does. And this allows these kind of countries to take on things like climate change and confront these kind of issues in a much more stronger and significant way, an effective way, and to think long term and really plan out, like, what they can do now to meet the needs of their citizens, their people, you know, like, you know, 5, 10, even 100 years in the case of Cuba, like, down the line. They can do this kind of thing. Capitalist countries cannot. And remember that the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that I mentioned earlier in the show. I mean, this report also stated that to successfully combat climate change, we need, quote, far-reaching transitions in energy, land, and industrial systems for which there is, quote, no documented historic precedent. That's what the report says. And I disagree. There is a very well-documented historic precedent for these things, and that precedent is socialism. As the progressive environmentalist John Bellamy Foster points out, the Soviet Union, you know, the USSR in the 1980s, possessed what was at the time the largest and most active environmental movement in the world. This often is not acknowledged, but it's true. The largest and most active environmental movement in the world, in the Soviet Union. And over the course of that single decade in the 1980s, the USSR's carbon emissions dropped by a factor of 25%. 25%. Thanks to effective central planning, the introduction of new technology, and the shutting down and/or retrofitting of older factories and power plants. 25% reduction in carbon emissions in the 1980s. This was years before the issue of global warming was even being considered at an international level. Almost 20 years before the Kyoto Protocol was signed. You know, and you already had Soviet scientists and ordinary Soviet citizens. They'd already identified the problem and put pressure on their socialist government to take concrete steps to solve it. In the 1980s, you know, way ahead of everybody else, way ahead of the rest of the world on this. They already saw what was coming. They already were taking action on climate change and emissions. As early as 1976, at the 25th CPSU Congress, you know, Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the Soviet government had decided to push for the development of new energy sources and green technology, including wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, and nuclear fusion. I mean, Vladimir Lenin himself, in the years after the Russian Revolution, had been considering the development of wind energy, even in the early 1920s, you know, to power what was then a largely rural economy in the Soviet Union. I mean, Soviet tidal power stations had been in operation in Siberia and on the coast of the White Sea as early as the 1960s. By 1985, solar power was being used to heat homes, children's summer camps, and recreational centers in many parts of the country. Geothermal electric stations of up to 1 million kilowatts were being built in the regions of Kamchatka, Dagestan, and Stavropol, while entire cities such as Grozny and Tbilisi were getting their heat from geothermal sources. Soviet scientists had even worked out the theoretical principles of how to tap enough heat energy from inside the earth to, quote, power the world for 3 or 4 millennia. Power the world for 3 or 4 millennia. And that's according to Dr. Kamil Mangushev, who headed the sector of economics of fuel and energy industry of the USSR Academy of Sciences. You know, this is the kind of cutting edge stuff that the Soviet Union was getting up to in the 1980s, and it produced results. As I said, a 25% reduction in carbon emissions before climate change was even on the table internationally. You know, the Soviet Union was already on top of that and was already making impressive strides in that sector. Impressive strides combating climate change. You know, the impressive example of the Soviet Union's achievements with regard to the environment and clean energy demonstrates why we need the means of production and the economy as a whole to be put under the democratic control of working class people. You know, all around the world, because today the question isn't socialism or barbarism. Today the question is socialism or extinction. And that's what we're facing when we face up to climate change. We face up to these like catastrophic shifts in the world right now, brought on by capitalism, you know, the kind of waste, the kind of pollution, the kind of degradation of the environment around the world, the ecosystems, the biosphere, the capitalist exploitation brings on, right? This is what we're facing right now. And of course, it's all to fuel the profits of the Fortune 500. That's what we need to stop. You know, and there's a lot of talk, you know, about building like a people-centered alternative, right? But of course, you know, they're not looking at these examples. They're not looking. People who say they want a people-centered alternative don't know about this kind of stuff. They don't know about the example of the Soviet Union. They don't know about the example of Cuba or what China's doing. You know, they don't know about this stuff. And so therefore, their solutions tend to be pretty lackluster, what they're proposing. So we really need to look at what socialism is capable of achieving. And there's these examples which are readily available. You can look at them. You know, they've gotten results. Frankly, this is the future we need to have. We need to have socialism. We need to have, like, the economy put under people's control if we want to survive. I mean, that's literally what's at stake here, brothers and sisters, and I really need to emphasize that. So there's only a few minutes left, so I'm going to sign off now, but just understand, you know, there are real examples that we can draw on here as we confront this massive challenge that we face in the world today. And that should give us hope. So take care, brothers and sisters. I'll see you all next week.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin. Attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs. I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascist crafted pantses, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word pack like 9 milli gat, rhymely packed punch, crash the fun by metric tons. And plus my math, distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church has to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick flow. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Original rap at taking it back. Boom bap, boom bap. Boom bap, original rap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.
We are Paisley Road Public School with our grade 4 class.
And you're listening to CMRU!
Do you have questions about sexual health strategies? Do you want to get tested to know your HIV status? Every Monday, HIV AIDS Resources and Community Health offers free, rapid HIV testing that is anonymous and confidential. Results are known within 20 minutes and no appointments are necessary. We offer the service on a first-come, first-served basis from 1:30 to 3 p.m. and we have extended hours every first and third Monday of the month from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Our nurse can also book follow-up appointments for other STI tests depending on your risk factors or results. Come check us out at our accessible location on 77 Westmount Road, Unit 110, or get more info at www.archguelph.ca/testing.
Tune in to Planet Groove for Funky Fridays on CFRU from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. with your Funky Funky Blues Doctor for a stir fry of funk, rock, blues, metal, and more. That's 10 a.m. every Friday on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.